Welcome to Let's Talk About Tess Baby, a fortnightly podcast where I discuss the things that testers are made of. Welcome to episode 62 of Let's Talk About Tess Baby. If you don't know, my name's Gem Hill. And this episode is going out the day before Tess Bash Manchester, which I am still incredibly excited about. So I'm just going to be off my face come the actual time for the conference. I will be there at the pre-meetup on Thursday, obviously the conference day Friday. I'm also talking at the open space on Saturday. So I'll be equal parts excited and absolutely bricking it throughout the conference. Come find me, let's chat. So let's jump straight into the episode. It is an interview with Neil Studd in a very echoey room, so I apologise. But the interview itself is awesome, so I hope you all enjoy. This week, I'm talking to Neil Studd. Hello, Neil.
Hello.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure. Glad to finally meet you.
Yeah, exactly. We've been talking for what seems like a while, like on Twitter and stuff, and now...
Yeah, it feels like it's been a very one-way relationship. I've been listening to the podcast since the start, and finally having a chance to talk back and say how much I appreciate it and how much I hope I can bring to it.
Yeah, it was great, because when I first started, I was going to do this like series of interviews. You were pretty much top of my list, like in my first people I was going to talk to. And then... I'd said, right, this weekend I'm going to send the emails, and then it's like on the Thursday or something, I got an email from you going, I'd like to be on the podcast. I was like, what is this? What is this synergy that we've got going on or something? So that was very timely.
It's fate.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so this week we're going to be talking about motivation, because you gave a talk on this in Brighton.
Yeah, the Brightest meetup in Brighton, I gave a talk about a variety of things around the subject of motivation, all of which have been interesting for a while. It was kind of an attempt to form my own idea of what I believe about these things, because I've been through a lot of different roles now. I've been testing in the UK for about 12 years, and I've been involved for a couple of years with weekend testing, which is an extra bit of working outside the workplace. And I'm seeing sort of the same things happening between these different jobs in terms of trying to motivate myself and also motivate those around me. And it's a real challenge. And a lot of people will brush it off and say, oh, you're just dealing about emotions, it's just feelings. And particularly if you're, especially if you're male, it's really difficult to talk about some of these things. People feel uncomfortable. But the fact is, it can have a profound physical impact on you. I went through quite a tough time recently, which I'm sure is going to come up during the talk, where, yeah, I put on 4 stone and I had to go and see the doctor due to various health issues. And this is all caused by... what I see of it, and you're just emotional issues.
Yeah,
if you bottle this stuff up, it can have a really negative impact on you.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I've been through it myself. Like, it was like last year and a bit the year before, but definitely last year, this time of year, I took on so much stuff that I got to like end of November, start of December. I was like, I can't do anymore. I literally can't, because there's just, and it was just affecting my work and everything, just because. There was just so much stuff going on.
Yeah, and the problem is the world isn't stopping around you.
Yeah, exactly.
Just because you need a break doesn't mean that the world thinks you do. And particularly for testers, there is so much change going on right now. When I was listening to your interview recently with Lee Rathbone, he was talking a lot about how change can have an effect on a team and how change affects people in different ways. The scale of change can also be a huge fact. And for me, the role of a tester is changing a lot more than the role of anything else in software development. When I look back at the first test role I had 12 years ago, I don't think that role even exists anymore. It was literally sitting there with a checklist, looking at a website, ticking things off, going, it does that, it does that, it does that. You probably wouldn't even employ a human to do that now. There's the whole shift left idea, the fact that you just need to increase your technical abilities. And Agile, for all the great things about it, that it brings us closer together, it also blurs those role boundaries.
Exactly, yeah.
And if you're not careful, I mean, it's brilliant that we get to say, we want our developers to be doing testing too, but then that's going to lead to questions of well, why do we need testers then?
Yeah, exactly.
Which can be difficult. And this sort of thing is uncomfortable for a lot of people.
Being vulnerable and giving your opinion about something that's so personal in a way, or just so scary, like considering your place in an ever-changing world, is so terrifying that you can't open yourself up to something like that.
Yeah, and yeah, it affects people in different ways. So this reminds me of a time when I worked for a small startup in Cambridge who were acquired by Oracle. And my first reaction when that happened was, I don't think I could have been hired by Oracle if I'd applied to them directly. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to really take full advantage of this. I'm going to use all the tools at their disposal. The fact that we've got teams all around the world. Best thing they had was an accessibility team who were staffed by people with actual impairment issues. So things that they had real blind users who came into our office and tested our software and explained why this wasn't going to work for them.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. So I was trying to really make the most of that opportunity.
Yeah.
The problem was every single other person in the test team had that same initial reaction of, I don't think Oracle would have hired me.
Yeah.
And they retreated into their shells. They went, okay, I'm going to keep my head down. I don't want to get found out.
Yeah, that I'm not worthy of this company. Yeah.
So it was the same initial reaction, but then sort of the whole fight or flight thing. You have to really carefully manage change.
Yes. It's one of those where you can't, like, there's a weird balance with change when you put in new processes and stuff where you need to make sure that you've got it right and that you're managing it well, but at the same time you don't want to spend so long over it that it never happens. Mm. And so there's a weird, sometimes people go too far one way or the other, so they'll just like go, right, this is it, this is what we're doing now, or they'll just be like stuck in development hell, for want of a better phrase, for forever. And so yeah, there's a weird balance going on there, especially when you can get the processes down, but then you've still got to put them on people and manage that as much as you manage the actual change itself. Like,
yeah,
putting that
it's
in
almost
place.
A full-time job in itself.
Exactly.
And just to be clear, I mean, when I give this talk at events, and I guess if you're listening to this now on the podcast, if you're listening to this, you might think, oh, well, this doesn't really apply to me. I'm kind of fine with managing my change. But I think you have to appreciate that people who listen to podcasts and people who go to events are kind of outliers. Those are already people who are showing an interest in furthering their career. Mm-hmm. And you have to appreciate that the number of people out there who just don't think in that way. They either don't know there's change going on around them, or they don't want to know about it. You can see that particularly if you go somewhere like groups on LinkedIn, and you get people who are very set in their ways, and they're like, oh, I want to write some awesome test cases, and you want to say, hey, have you thought about maybe there's other things out there?
Yeah, maybe not test cases. Who knew? Yeah, definitely.
The challenge is that there's so much to learn, and it's all around you, that the chances to learn. So, for example, if you're listening to a podcast, someone might refer to a book, and then you decide to read that book, and that book references five or six other books and a selection of blogs you might want to read.
Yep.
And it just goes on and on and on, and you can very easily just get buried in the amount of work to do.
Yeah.
There was a great cartoon I saw on Twitter recently by Gemma Correll, who's an American writer. She said that you have the classic two personality types. You've got the early birds and the night owls, depending on what you're a preference for. But I associate myself with a third type that Gemma mentioned, which is the permanently exhausted pigeon.
Yeah, I am definitely identifying with the permanently exhausted pigeon.
Up early, late at night, and no end in sight for how that's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's really easy to just burn out through that. So I had an experience with this last year where it just came out of nowhere. It started with just a handful of sleepless nights, and I didn't think much of it. There was a lot going on in my life, and I thought, that's fine, I'll cope with that. At its worst, I had a week-long period where I had less than an hour's sleep each night. And by the end of that week, it was like just being permanently jet-lagged. It was dangerous for me to get behind the wheel, because I didn't know where I was.
Yeah.
And I went to the doctor just saying, oh, can you get me something that will help me sleep? And thankfully, doctors are a lot like testers. They want to know the why behind it. And they start to say, you know what? Why aren't you sleeping? Can we look into that maybe?
Yeah.
And actually, they diagnosed me with adrenal fatigue, which is basically, your body just is reacting to your amount of work by, anytime it looks like you're about to drift to sleep, it pumps you full of adrenaline to keep you awake. Because it goes, no, you were supposed to be busy. And there are four different stages of adrenal fatigue. And apparently I was still only a stage 2 case, but stage 3 is like your hormones start getting rewritten and it's a 6-month recovery time.
Yeah, because that's permanent. Yeah.
So what I learned was, I have to regulate my work better than I do. Because as you were saying earlier, I find it very hard to say no to things. I'm still in the phase of my career where I'm honoured to be asked to do things. And I feel bad saying, actually, I can't do that right now.
Yeah, same. I got asked to give a talk at a conference that's next week or a couple of weeks, like end of September, I think, and I was like, I would absolutely love to, but I actually cannot. And that's because I had the same situation as you last year, in that it was this time of year, which I always say that September to December is the worst time of year for me, because it's also the best time of year. I've got so much stuff going on, but I also have so much stuff going on. And last year I completely burnt out. I was barely making it to work. I was like, I can't do this anymore. And then it was Christmas and there's just so much stuff going on. So yeah, I said no to something, the first big thing this year, and I was like, proud of myself. Like, I'm disappointed I can't do this thing, but I'm so proud of myself for actually saying, you know what, I can't do it.
Yeah. So the way I found that really helps with this is, perversely, to spend more time organising what you're doing. It sounds like you're taking on more work, but using things like personal Kanban. So If you've seen that, it's like a something like a Trello board that has three columns, like a to-do, doing, and done. You put yourself a WIP limit in place, so you can only work in progress on up to, say, two items at a time, just to physically limit the amount of stuff you can take on.
Mm-hmm.
The extra thing that I do on my Kanban board, which I haven't seen anyone else talk about, so I think I might have invented it, is to have an extra column on there called rewards.
Yes.
And what I'd fill my rewards column with is just things I'd like to do, like go to an outdoor film screening, take a day at the beach, that sort of thing. And I impose a rule on myself that every time I move five tasks to done, I must play a rewards card before I'm allowed to take any more work on. I force myself to take time off, which is probably still not healthy, but at least I acknowledge the fact that I don't do it enough and I need to make myself do it.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got to make yourself do it, then that's fine. The point is, as long as you do it, as long as that doesn't become as stressful as doing the other things, as long as I have to relax.
It does a little bit. Yeah, there could be the frustration of I need to pick a really good reward to take, but it's better to get frustrated about how am I going to go and have fun than I've got too much to do.
Definitely.
It's a fairly healthy kind of frustration.
But
you've spoken before on the podcast about imposter syndrome as well, about the fact that there's all this stuff to do, there's all this stuff that you either don't know or that you could still learn about. There's one thing that I study that I love to refer to when it comes to imposter syndrome, because it explains it and it rationalizes it all. It's what's known as the Dunning-Kruger effect. So this is a graph and a study that was done that shows when you first start to learn about a subject or a topic, your confidence in what you know shoots up to a massively high level. You massively exaggerate how much you know about something.
Yeah.
And that peak there is what's known as the Dunning-Kruger effect, and explains why when you're, for example, you're interviewing people for a job and they claim to know lots about something, but they actually don't when they're tested on it, and it's because they think they do. The challenge is, with the Dunning-Kruger effect, once you push past that point of thinking you know everything, there's this really unhealthy bit, or seemingly unhealthy bit, where you're learning more and more information, but your confidence is going down and down and down as you realise just how much more there is that you can know.
Yeah.
And on this graph, at least the first 50% of it is spent on this downward cycle of there's so much more to do here. And it's really, really hard to push past that downward cycle and back to a point where you're learning and also feeling more confident about what you know.
Yeah.
And with when we talk about testing and all the different technology stacks that you need to learn, all the different illities that you can learn more about, there are so many of these little graphs going on in your head at any one time that you could just be paralysed by imposter syndrome.
Indecision about what you need to learn more about at any one time. Like, I have a thing, I've referenced that I'm a magpie many times, in that I have so many things that I want to learn about that I can't sit down and focus on one thing, and so it kind of adds on top of the, not only do I not know anything at all, I also can't convince myself to learn anything at all, and so it just kind of, so it's just like there's like the volume, you know, there's so much stuff that you don't know, but you don't know what to pick at first to learn. There's no, because there's no clear career path, it's not like, oh, you learn this and then this and this and then you're a tester. You're just kind of paralysed by indecision over it all.
Yeah.
I have a Trello, which is not a Kanban board, but I do need to get myself into a Kanban board. My Trello currently has... So the way I've got it set up is that if I like something from the podcast Twitter, it makes a Trello card, and then I can put that into something I want to learn about, something I want to just tweet, or something that I can write an episode about. I need to stop doing that, because I currently have about 20 cards just in the True View one, and I've got about 6 in the further review and about 7 I want to write a podcast about. So this Kanban doesn't work in all the ways a Kanban doesn't work, and that is because I've started in response to the burnout and response to everything else and some other stuff, I've just started going, right, I'm not going to do any work, I'm not going to do any testing on Saturday.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do anything on a Saturday. I'm going to take a day off, like on a Sunday, my other half goes out for a run, so I've got like an hour and a half in the house to myself, I can edit a couple of episodes, but on a Saturday, I'm not going to do any work.
Yeah.
I'm just going to just go to the cinema or sit on my sofa all day or something.
Yeah, and that's totally healthy. I mean, there are various discussions about whether or not there's even such a thing as work-life balance. Certainly I used to subscribe to an idea that it's all life, it all feeds into the same thing, and you live for what you want to do.
Yeah.
That's what I thought until I had another episode last year where my relationship came to a very sudden end for various reasons. But the important thing that I learned there was that you may have your own idea of what your work-life balance is, or your own idea of what it means to have a work-life balance, But there are other people in your life, be it partners, children, family, friends, mm-hmm. who may have different expectations. And you need to be really careful that just because you're content with how your own work-life balance is, make sure that other people around you feel the same way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so there's this thing about 9-to-5 testers, and like, you, as a tester, you should be learning loads outside work, and you need to make sure you're giving value every day. And I kind of agree with at least the giving value every day, and there's some stuff you can learn in your own time, but at the same time, you've got to make sure that you actually do things that aren't work. I feel so much more energised after I've started doing this. I don't want to do work on a Saturday. Hmm. And there's so many things. I'm not getting test fatigue, which I found was a thing I was getting. I was like, I'm doing so much work on testing that I'll get into work on a Monday and just look and go, I can't remember how to test anymore.
Yeah.
Because I've done so much of it that my brain's just like, I'm out. Well, and I think there's a real value to sometimes saying, I'm not going to do any overtime, I'm not going to do any work in my own time for a bit, or I can't, because some people can't. And there's a weird thing, like, with the privilege of saying I'm going to work outside work, I can go and lock myself in a room and do something, where not everyone can do that. There are responsibilities. The first thing you get in how do you want to be a tester is come to all these meetups in the community and stuff like that. You're wiping out a huge amount of the community who literally cannot.
Yeah, and a failure to do that sort of thing for any reason doesn't mean a lack of interest.
Absolutely.
I think that's a really important thing. It's funny you should mention 9-to-5 testers. That's kind of a thing that I keep getting known for. When I gave this talk in Brighton and someone tweeted something I said about 9-to-5 testers, I think it was Richard Bradshaw tweeted back saying, oh, I was going to say you should talk to Neil Studd about that because he has ideas. And then I realised he was the speaker.
It's kind of
my thing, yeah. It's an accusation that gets thrown at people of why are they 9-to-5 testers, when what they mean is, why are the people who aren't here on a particular evening or at a particular event? And there are many, many more reasons other than a lack of interest that could cause that. People have families and commitments, and that's absolutely okay.
Yeah,
some people just like to have boundaries between their work and home life. There was, when I gave this Brighton talk, someone replied saying, I'm 9-to-5 and proud of it. I give 100% to my employer while I'm in the workplace, and in exchange, I'm allowed to take 100% of that time for my family when I'm at home.
Exactly.
And if you're the important thing when people are talking about 9-to-5 testers, they're rarely saying that these are bad testers. If the question was, why is this person not willing to learn?
Yeah.
Then that's a different question, and you can look at how you would address that. Just someone's unwillingness to attend a particular event doesn't mean they're not interested, or that they're not a serious professional.
Exactly.
One of the things that I struggle with, I'm trying to get over it, is I'm a heavy, heavy introvert. And importantly, being an introvert doesn't mean being shy. I mean, I love talking to people, I love meeting people, but that sort of thing just drains me. And I used to think that that was kind of a stigma against introverts, the fact that you should be aspiring to be an extrovert, and that introverts are somehow frowned upon. Until I read a book last year called Quiet by Susan Cain, which is all about the power of the introvert. It shows lots of really useful examples of how, obviously, diversity within a team is great. You need people who are good at that deep thought, sitting in a corner, just thinking about how to do something. There's not necessarily any correlation between being really good at talking and being the person with the best ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
And you need to be able to foster that crossover between your team and support both things. And the other good thing about Susan's book was it points out that actually, although introverts have all these struggles, extroverts have equivalent struggles. So for an extrovert, it's really difficult for them to sit down and knuckle down on their own on a task for a while, because that drains their energy. They want to then build that energy back again by going and talking to someone, by going to the kitchen and having a conversation.
Exactly.
So there's an equal and equivalent challenge for both kinds of people, and it's not a binary divide. You can be slightly introverted, slightly extroverted.
Because I enjoy interacting with people, and I'm quite good once I've broken that, the first thing, I'm quite good at talking to people. But working up to that, and then after that, it's just kind of like the first, like when I went to Test Bash Brighton, that was my first like testing conference. And I think I didn't talk to anyone before the first talk. Couldn't bring myself to do it. Walked out my first talk, Lee Rathbone walked up to me, and that was it. I was introduced to like half the people there. I met people who I'd spoken to over Twitter, and that was it. And I was in my element, but couldn't do it. I could not walk up to a single person before my first talk and talk to someone. I just sat by myself, can't do it.
I had a really similar experience recently at CAST in Vancouver, which was my first conference I'd done in North America. which meant meeting a whole completely new set of people. Yeah. So although I'd got kind of used to talking to people in the Ministry of Testing community, mm-hmm. and people who I'd seen at other events, this was thrusting myself into a load of people I'd never seen before. And I made a list on Twitter of all the people I'd met after the conference. And I think there were 48 people on that list, 48 new faces.
Yeah.
And I had an amazing time. And we had some really good social activities of the evening as well. But still, every night, I was the first one to leave. And it wasn't because I wasn't enjoying myself. It was like, I need to recharge. This is going to be too much for me. And I had a great time, but I wasn't one of the all-nighter crowd. Again, it's making myself comfortable with that. That's who I am. And to make the most of what I'm comfortable doing. So it's really difficult to struggle through those personal challenges to actually feel comfortable in that sort of environment. And so when we talk about 9-to-5 tests and say, how can we change these people? I think we need to flip it around. We need to say, how can we bring this material from these events back to people who don't cope well in this sort of environment?
Yeah, how can we support these people?
Yeah, maybe that's doing brown bag sessions in your mm-hmm. workplace, or writing reports, or sharing videos if the presentation has been streamed online, mm-hmm. Just to actually make sure that people can interact with that sort of environment.
At one point, people I used to work with was doing a keynote at a Drupal conference in Barcelona. And so what we did at work is we have a big TV that we put like company presentations on. They put the live stream up on there, so anyone who wanted to watch it could just sit in our communal like auditorium area. They could still work. I had laptops with them, but they were streaming the talk for anyone to watch, and just stuff like that. If you want to spend just have that in the background so people can look and take notes and stuff. Yeah. And I thought that was really good.
And that inclusivity is important. It's about making it available for anyone in the format they want. But also not enforcing it on people. You know, we're not saying you have to come and watch this thing, because if someone feels like it's been forced upon them, it could be less effective. So one of the talks that I saw at CAST was by Nancy Kelm, and it's not one of the ones that was web streamed, but she was talking about her experiences with trying to introduce the ideas of exploratory testing into mm-hmm. various companies she'd worked in, and how that had or hadn't worked. And she gave one experience where it hadn't worked, where she'd been given free rein to do what she wanted to the team, and she said, great, we're going to throw out all of these old test cases, these old manual scripts that we've been running. I'm going to send you all on the rapid software testing course, and then you're going to come back and you're going to do rapid software testing, and it's going to be brilliant, right?
Oh God, that sounds terrible.
And yeah, and she found that the change wasn't as successful as she thought. And when she spoke to the team about why hasn't this worked, basically their opinion was, well, you've taken this one dogmatic approach by saying you have to write test cases, and you've replaced it with another one. You've told us we have to do rapid software testing.
Yeah.
They didn't have any buy-in to it. And you need to be really careful that people find their own value in what you're doing,
yeah.
and not to just say, you're going to do it this way. For me, the classic book about motivational techniques and how motivation works is by Dan Pink, and it's called Drive.
Now, is that book good? Because I've seen people at work read it, and I've not had a chance to read it yet.
It's brilliant, not just in terms of, like, it has lots of actual case studies that show how motivation works, but also in practical advice on how you can go about improving things. So one of the case studies he uses is by two people called Lepper and Green, and they did a study among children, but they've repeated the results with adults as well, where they took a group of children in, like, a nursery or a primary school, a group that had shown interest in drawing. And they said, right, we're going to split you into three groups. Group number one, what we're going to do is we're going to incentivize you to go and do some drawing. We'll say, we're going to give you a reward if you go and do some drawing now. Mm-hmm. The second group, they just sent off to do some drawing. And then afterwards, they gave them the same reward afterwards, but they didn't know it was coming.
Okay.
And the third group was just a control group who they just let go and draw, and they didn't get any reward at the end, but they didn't know there was going to be any reward. And then they reported on how they all seemed to have equal amounts of enjoyment on the day of how much they enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing came 2 weeks later when they came back to that same school and looked at what those three groups were doing during their playtime. And two of those three groups were still really keen on drawing. But the third group, the one that had now associated drawing with being given a reward up front, were doing it less, because they were kind of saying, you rewarded me before. Why would I go and do that without a reward?
Yeah, what am I doing this for?
Yeah, so this is why Dan talks about the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic rewards. So extrinsic rewards is anything that might be money or anything visible about, we're going to compensate you for doing this.
Yeah.
But intrinsic motivation is actually having internal enjoyment for doing something, actually feeling empowered to do it. Mm-hmm. And the three factors that help give better performance, better personal satisfaction, Dan talks about, are autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So autonomy is not being told how to do something, just being told, here's the goal. You get there whatever way you like.
You just need to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. You might fail along the way, and that failure is part of the learning process, yeah. and that's okay. But you're free to go and do it. You might have, for example, time constraints because we've only got so many hours in the day. But yeah, you're free to go and do that the way you want. Mastery is having the time to actually achieve mastery. So not just rushing through something and then parking it and never using that tool again. Example of that came up at work for me recently was one of my colleagues was thinking about putting a blog post together about how he used a particular tool. And he was holding back because he said, I don't think I've used all of this tool to its full potential. I've maybe only used 10% of this tool. And I was like, well, it doesn't matter. You've got real value out of that 10%. Yeah, you exactly. identified that 10% will give you value. You found that tool. You used it to solve a problem. Why not tell people about that? You don't need to be an actual master to have mastery.
No, absolutely not.
And the final thing is purpose. So having a reason for doing it. So yeah, if you're told you've got to do something, but no one explains why, and no one explains who's going to get value out of that at the end, then that just is a thankless task of, you're a button pushing monkey. The important thing is to give people some sense of agency over their own situation. So, letting people shape their own path, understanding what they're trying to get to, but finding their own way to do it.
So I actually saw there's a talk I'm going to link to. I went to a conference and there was a project manager who gave a fantastic talk about autonomy, mastery and purpose. I'll link it in the show notes. And she's a digital project manager and she's... But basically, her goal was to get those three things in place at every company that she ever went to. And she could great talk on how she brings it in and the different ways of doing it and things like that. It's a really good talk.
And the important thing to remember in all of that is, your company that you work for, assuming you work for a company, has a commitment to keep you developed. A lot of companies say they do. Like, they'll say you have 5% or 10% time, but realistically, you're always doing... You're busy on your project. That. Everything else is always a higher priority.
Yeah.
You'll have things like... I always find I work for companies who claim to have a training budget, but no one really knows how much it is or necessarily who controls the strings to that. You really need to try and make your own way into that. You need to find out what's available to you, maximise your usage of it.
And also, when I went to Test Bash, I bought an early bird ticket myself, and then I went to my land manager at the time and went, I bought this ticket to this conference. Do you want to pay me back? And they went, yeah, sure, that's fine. But I know that if I'd have asked for it, they would have missed the early bird tickets because the grind of bureaucracy... And so I just went out and did it and got to paying back. I was like, right, I'm forcing you to do it, basically, because I want to go. It's important to me.
Yeah, you have to be careful not to dig yourself too many holes in that in case you don't get the money back. But
you have to have that knowledge and that political capital, which I did at the time.
But the classic phrase is, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Yes.
Yeah. There was a really good talk on this, actually, at CAST as well, by a chap from Australia or New Zealand called Pete Bartlett, who's one of the speakeasy speakers. And his talk was about basically creating the change that you want in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And his talk was very much around when we get frustrated, we'll often look to change jobs. We'll go, this is going to be better if I go somewhere else. Yeah. But actually, it's a lot easier and a lot less painful to try and make that change in the organisation you're in right now, mm-hmm. rather than worrying about upheaval. You have, as you said, you have your own reputation that you can actually effectively spend in your organisation. You can say, hey, I've done good things X, Y and Z. Why don't we look at these other things that are interesting?
Yeah.
And if there's resistance to change, then you just explore what the reasons are for that resistance. If your boss is saying, you can't do this, it's not normally because he's being negligent or he's trying to be deliberately obtrusive. It may be that he thinks there's a different objective to follow right now. And actually, understanding why your organisation is resistant can be a big part of solving the problem.
The talk I'm giving, hopefully at Test Bash, I've got a mind map, and one of the things is, there may be a reason for the stupid-ass policy. And if you find out the reason, you can then find out if that reason's valid and if there's another way of doing it. But there's probably a reason for that policy you think is the worst thing in the world. Yeah. And you can't just rail against something without railing against the underlying reason.
Yeah, it's so easy to find situations that are frustrating and just let them just destroy you.
Yeah.
I keep finding myself going through this cycle where I will join an organisation, I will become a really passionate advocate of that organisation, I'll tell people how great they are to work for, and then I'll see them doing really dumbass things that I can't change. And I'll try and change them and they won't change. And then I find myself moving on to a different company because I've just got fed up with the place.
Yeah.
And I could stay at a company a lot longer if I didn't let that sort of thing bother me. If I wasn't so passionate, I might be less bothered. And it's one of these tough things. Mm-hmm. I am a passionate person. Should I be letting this sort of thing bother me? Or do I need to just let some of it wash over me?
Yeah, and everyone has their own line of what bothers them on a personal level to the point of not being able to wash over it and just get on with the work. It's kind of almost we talk about the 9-to-5 testers, there is a limit to say, I can leave all this stuff
at work when I walk out the door. But if you see something that you feel is so, you know, out there, you're just like, no, I can't let this slide. I've got to do something or move on. And there is a weird balance there between being so passionate but not being so passionate that it just kind of, yeah, eats you up a bit.
Yeah, and you need to try and capture these things in the moment. So
we've talked about like changing, using like political capital and all the rest of it that you can do. Sometimes that can backfire, because I've heard people say that if no one's speaking up, they must not have a problem with it. And that comes back to, in a way, to supporting like introverts, extroverts, and that kind of diversity, that not everyone is going to feel up to or able to speak out. I've had people come to me and say, I want, like, when one of the developers went on holiday, and he said, I want to hand it over to you because I know you'll make a noise about some of the issues in this project, and I know that you're happy to make that noise. Because I have that reputation of making a noise about things. And I think it goes back to introverts, extroverts, that not everyone is going to feel extroverted enough in their workplace, especially if they're new to the company, to go out there and say, I think this is wrong, loudly. And so there's a case of supporting those different approaches as well.
Yeah, and it's great when people can see that in you and understand that you're the go-to person because you've got trait X, Y, or Z. The challenge is that there are a lot of people who are struggling with problems that aren't visible on the surface at all. Mm-hmm. Either they don't want to show them, if it's something like depression, or they might have something that isn't very well understood. Like it might be like autism or
something like developmental thing, or something that's not well. If it's not well known, because everyone knows depression, anxiety, but the more stuff like autism, like ADHD, like that kind of stuff, they're still fairly stigmatized or associated with children.
Yeah,
like. People think you grow out of those things when you don't. You just learn to hide them, or you just deal with them in whatever way.
Yeah, so there's a absolute must-watch webinar online on YouTube that came from CAST this year by Sally Ann Freudenberg. She did a talk called Neurodiversity in Software Development. Mm-hmm. And it was about, you said that it's commonly associated with children. She has an autistic son. And it was only when she began to understand the way in which his mind worked that she realised, actually, I have a lot of these traits myself. And she realised that actually she suffered with a lot of the same things. Mm-hmm. And it's just a really, not just emotional, but just valuable talk about understanding the way people are physically different. And we're spending too long trying to shape our workplaces into these cookie-cutter situations where, like, oh, we're all going to go open space now. But some people, actually, you may have, like, a hearing impairment or something that makes it difficult for you to operate in that sort of environment. You may want to be in a quiet space for some time. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether on the video it comes across just how much buzz there was in the room, but it was it's a heartwarming and just really enlightening talk about these different kinds of people that we're effectively excluding from our workplaces just because we're trying to make these generalised environments.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said about, obviously, you want to like cater to as many people as possible, but you also need, there are specific things you can do, and sometimes those things are so small that it's worth doing for the right person, but that person's got to feel comfortable speaking up and all the rest of it. I mean, I'm quite lucky in that the company I work in, there's people have paved the way, so I can speak up. I can say, I can say to my boss, like, I was in a one-to-one, I went, this is really triggering my anxiety, it's really screwing me up, and I can tell you exactly why, but this is what's happening, and I felt perfectly comfortable doing that. But that's only because people have done it openly before me. If you're pretty sure the only person there with that neuro, you know, that issue that you don't necessarily, and you don't know if you're going to be stigmatized or not, it's all about trying to get support and trying to make obvious things to make sure you support these kind of issues.
And that's why I like to talk about this sort of thing is because it's not spoken about. The fact that it affects a lot of people are suffering in silence, and understanding that not only are you not alone, but people have been going through this problem before. There are support networks out there for you. Talking about it is a great step to understanding it. So when I went through my relationship breakup, obviously that kind of coincided with also with my career doing really well. That was a really tough thing to understand, was actually, you know, I've succeeded, but at what cost? And having to learn to come to terms with that and just talk openly about it has been helpful, because I've just been able to talk things through openly in ways that I wouldn't have done otherwise. And you don't necessarily have to tell the whole world. You certainly don't need to do it on a podcast.
No, exactly.
But yeah, having a close-knit circle of people you can rely on. So yeah, I had a go-to person in my team who I talked about this sort of issue. I had a go-to person in my family, even if I didn't want to share it with the entire family, and a go-to person outside of all that, just a friend. Just having one person in any given situation who I'd say, hey, this is really tough, can I just unload on you for a bit? Yeah. Can be really useful.
It's for me, it's the same, almost the same principle as the rubber duck principle. Like, it doesn't matter what or who you talk to, but sometimes just actually forcing yourself to verbalise these things or write these things down, because there's such a difference between the thoughts in your head when they're not really fully formed and just getting them out there.
Yeah.
It makes a huge difference. And one of the reasons that I keep, we were talking before we started recording, I realised that I don't have many technical testing talks that are all about the human side of talking, but that's what I'm interested in, and I want to get so many different stories out there. It's one of the reasons I'm doing yet another podcast, because I think just trying to break some, it's not even stigma, just trying to break the silence, just the other plenty of people are like this. I just think it's so important, and it's just so helpful, that I just want to give everyone a chance just to, I'm just going to come around and shove a mic in everyone's faces, is that okay? You know what I mean?
Yeah, just raise awareness, increase the signal.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do, yeah.
So yeah, the whole challenge around motivation is a difficult one.
Yeah,
there's no right answer. And what I found is there are a few simple things that I can keep in mind to just keep me on the right path. So number one is to forge your own career path. Don't assume anyone else is going to do that for you. If you could take other people with you along that path and help them to learn too, then great. But don't hold yourself back because you think someone else needs to be brought with you. Number two is to use all the tools that are at your disposal. So particularly in the workplace, find out what budget you've got. Find out how much time you're allowed to go off and do side projects. Find out how open they are to funding you to go to conferences.
And just talk to other people in your company. Even if it's not even another tester, you might find, like I've been seeing it with Python, so I've just grabbed other developers who I know Python and go, help me out here, please. People are a resource at the end of the day. If you can find people in your company, use them.
Yeah, you mentioned it's hard to become a specialist in many things at the same time. Well, there probably are other people who are specialists in those things. Yeah. So, yeah, come to rely on them and learn from them.
Yeah.
Number three is to be true to yourself. So I've talked a bit about how I've got things wrong at work and at home. But the important thing is to have a sense of integrity, to do things for the right reasons. If things go wrong, then at least you can just know that you don't waste your time second-guessing things.
Yeah,
you have the best intentions, and to have respect for other people. And number four is to just leave room to enjoy life outside the office. And if you want to work outside the office and improve yourself in your spare time, then great, but don't think that you have to. And certainly don't feel that you have to sacrifice other parts of your life to do so.
Absolutely not. Like, most of us, I assume, find testing enjoyable, but that doesn't mean you have to do it all the time. It's one of the reasons I went down to fortnightly on this podcast. I was like, I don't have time. I'm going to do it 2 weekly.
Yeah, and the important thing, having that extra happiness and being healthier will actually make you into a better tester, because you've got more focus and you've got more time to focus on the things that interest you.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. I could do it anytime. Probably not anymore. I think I'm done for today.
Yeah. But, you know, my microphone is always open if you want to come on again.
Thank you very much.
And that was episode 62. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I enjoyed talking to Neil a lot, and I hope people get something from the conversation that we had. And I'm going to leave it there for this week. As I said previously, I'll be at Test Bash Manchester, so I'll definitely speak to a few of you there. If not, we'll be back on the 3rd of November with episode 63. In the meantime, if you want to hit me up, letstalkabouttests@gmail.com, @letstalktests on Twitter. There were a lot of links in this episode. They're all on the post at letstalkabouttests.xyz. And if that's not enough, why don't you go rate and review us on iTunes, because that always helps. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye. Our planet will be just a point of light.